My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to the Christmas episode of Mysteries and Monsters. Fresh from surviving meeting a trio of Krampus, or Krampi, I'm not sure what the plural for more than one Krampus is, at the wonderfully spooky Creswell Crags in Nottinghamshire yesterday to celebrate the winter solstice, nothing says Christmas more than talking about Bigfoot. I'm delighted to be rejoined by Ken Gerhardt, who returns to the show to discuss his brand new book, The Essential Guide to Bigfoot. It's a refreshing, no-nonsense book that Ken breaks the Bigfoot conundrum into a series of informative and well-written chapters focusing on the North American hominid. With a foreword by Peter Byrne, Ken's book is a fantastic addition to any cryptid collection, be you obsessed with all things Bigfoot or completely new to the phenomenon. We discuss some of the cases Ken covers, the characters and investigators he mentions, and how his own experiences and investigations have left him feeling towards the Bigfoot mystery. Before we dive in, a massive congratulations to Shannon Legros from Into the Fray, who's just released her debut book, which is co-authored with G. Michael Hoff, called Beyond the Fray, Bigfoot. So make sure you bag yourself a copy. And Shannon, you're always welcome to come and talk all things cryptid on here as well anytime. Don't forget, you can join us on social media by following us on Facebook at Mysteries and Monsters. We're on Instagram and Twitter as Mystery Monsters. And you can also subscribe to our channel on YouTube. Right. So have yourselves a fantastic Christmas. And let's talk Bigfoot with Ken Gerhardt. My guest this week is world-renowned author, investigator, and cryptozoologist Ken Gerhardt. Ken has previously joined us back on episode 22, and I am delighted he has returned to discuss his fantastic new book, The Essential Guide to Bigfoot. Ken, delighted to welcome you back to Mysteries and Monsters. How are we?
I'm doing well, Paul. Thank you again for having me on. Glad I didn't scare you off, and it's always a pleasure to speak with you, my friend.
Oh, thank you very much. You're very kind. I've read the book cover to cover. I think it's a fantastic compendium of the world of Bigfoot. So I'll start you off with an easy one, Ken. Why did you think we needed a book like this?
Well, Paul, I didn't really feel there was a need to write a Bigfoot book because there are many excellent books out there and continue to be excellent books coming out written by some of my colleagues. But, I'm finding on a daily basis that I'm, dealing with a lot of misperceptions and falsehoods. And, sadly, there's a lot of bad information out there online and not to be overly critical of anyone in particular, but, there are a lot of websites and posts and videos and so forth that I think are misleading. And sadly, I certainly think that Bigfoot is worthy of, it's an iconic mystery and it's kind of worthy of our of all of us giving it very, very much a critical perspective, but also, to be open-minded. But Anyways, yeah, it's really to counter a lot of the what I call the deluge of drivel, which is just a lot of bad information and just downright fabrications and hoaxes, and that's always been a part of the field, of course. So that's a lot of it. And I wanted it to be kind of an introduction, a primer to those people that might be casually interested in the topic. But additionally, I also wanted to, perhaps uncover some little nuggets, if you will, here or there, pieces of information that even my seasoned Bigfoot investigator colleagues might find useful, because there are many stories and accounts that have been, long discussed in the Bigfoot field. But as we go, through time, there are certain truths that have come to light, and those are often overlooked as well. So, essentially, I just wanted to put something out there that had a lot of accurate information. And even if people don't think that Bigfoot could exist, but are still curious about the topic, hopefully it'll open some minds that, there is some foundational science, and there have been some findings that have been amassed over the decades in this field that I think are significant.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, as you refer to there, Ken. It really is a fantastic primer for anyone, even with someone who's read about it over the years or is completely new to the topic. And I think that's one of the outstanding strengths of the book, is I think it's easy to read regardless of your knowledge of the phenomena.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. Yeah, I tried to make it sort of like a textbook. Imagine if someone is enrolling into Bigfoot 101 at the local college, and they need all of the basic information to begin to formulate an opinion. And again, there is a lot of evidence out there, and there's a lot of bad information, as I said, and a lot of that stuff has been embraced and sort of proliferated for various reasons, which I think is very damaging to the integrity of the subject of the mystery.
Yeah, I think it's very refreshing as well the way you've approached this book, Ken, because there are certain well-known incidents. Obviously, the Patterson-Gimlin is mm-hmm. legendary around the world, where you've essentially not spent that much time on it because it's been so widely discussed and covered over the years. And I think that's a real strength and gives the book a real depth in regards to the fact that it doesn't just focus on the stories that everybody knows. It goes into some case. I mean, there's a couple of cases that I've probably not been as well versed with. The Ruby Creek story is one that I didn't think I'd ever come across before, and that's a fantastic series of witness statements and experiences. What was it like when you came across certain stories like that, Ken? Because forgive my ignorance if I'm wrong, but Ruby Creek seems to be exactly what you're pointing to in regards to a story that just dropped off the map.
Yeah, probably one of the most important Bigfoot accounts, mainly for the reason that prior to the 1940s, 1950s, Sasquatch, because Bigfoot had not quite made it onto the scene until the late 1950s, but in Canada, there were many newspaper articles and magazine articles that referred to the Sasquatch, which were largely viewed as a sort of local folklore or Native American folklore by most of the Westerners living there in Canada. And it was the Sasquatches were described as like a race of big hairy Indians that lived out in the woods. But again, it was viewed as kind of a colorful legend. But in 1941, at a place called Ruby Creek along the Fraser River in British Columbia, Canada, where many of these Sasquatch legends were well known, there was a family that encountered a Sasquatch that came onto their property, scared them off the property. Left a number of deep footprints in the ground and broke apart a barrel full of smoked salmon and basically left a lot of evidence behind. The Chapman family, Mr. Chapman was at work that day, but his wife Jean was at home with the kids, and she was the one that rustled all the kids off to safety when this thing came onto their property. But shortly thereafter, the property was visited by her husband, George, and some of his coworkers at the local railroad there. and as well as some other local people, and including a mixture of both native people and also white people, Anglos, that lived in the area. And they all saw the evidence. They saw the footprints. They were very impressive, about I think about 16 inches long, if I'm not mistaken, and impressed deep in the ground. They seemed to circle the property, which was a little shack that they lived in there on the river. And again, the remnants of this barrel that had been ripped apart and some of the fish partially eaten. So that was pretty significant, because I think to a lot of the Anglos that were there on the scene, that suddenly there was this mythical creature stepped into reality. It had actually appeared on this property and terrorized this family. Mm-hmm. And also there was a sort of an early Bigfoot investigator, a guy named Sheriff Joe Dunn from Bellingham, Washington, that heard about the incident. He came up from Washington State, wasn't too far a drive. And he saw the evidence and, in fact, made a plaster cast of one of the footprints, which stuck around for – sadly, I hear this particular foot casting that he made, this plaster cast, eventually was broken apart by his children. It was used as a doorstop in his house and largely abused, which is very a tragic chapter in the Bigfoot mystery itself. But fortunately, someone made a tracing of the foot cast before it disintegrated. And that tracing made its way to John Green, of course, who is a famous chronicler of Sasquatch and Bigfoot accounts through the years. And so that particular tracing would again become relevant when in 1958, John Green traveled down to Bluff Creek, California to look at some Bigfoot prints. Now the name Bigfoot had now hit the scene. It had been publicized in newspapers. And they were identical. These footprints that he saw along the creek were identical to the tracing that he had from Canada. So I think that was the first point that we were able to officially connect the dots between so-called Bigfoot and the legend of Sasquatch. We knew that there was a creature that was prevalent in both British Columbia and Northern California. So a very significant case. As you said, it's not really mentioned these days much, but back in the early days of Bigfooting in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, it was very well known as one of the most credible Bigfoot Sasquatch encounters.
Yeah. I think for me, the thing that makes it such a compelling story, Ken, is the fact that the epilogue to all this is that the family just moved away. They were terrified.
Yes, they were. They were. In fact, they abandoned the property. It was, as you can imagine, a very traumatic experience for all of them. And of course, they were worried about the safety of their children. I'm sure they didn't. Nobody really knew what a Sasquatch would do or if it were capable of abducting. There were native legends of Sasquatches abducting people, so I guess that might have been in the back of their minds. So that was well known throughout the Bigfoot field that they had abandoned the property. But what I did not know, and thanks to an excellent researcher named John Kirk, who lives up in British Columbia and has for many years, a well-known cryptozoologist, John was able to investigate the property, interview some of the descendants and people that were still familiar with the case, and found out that the Chapmans had, in fact, gone back. You know, they couldn't abandon. I guess they were very probably very poor and couldn't immediately abandon the property, so they went back and gave it another go. But they did experience other activity in the following week, other sounds, calls and screams in the night. And just this looming presence of this creature was still kind of lurking around their property. And so at that point, they were definitely checking out and managed to get out of there. So that, you know, that little tidbit kind of reinforces the fact that there was actually something that was going on there, because as is the case with other Bigfoot encounters, these creatures often do, for whatever reason, seem to hang around a specific location for at least a short period of time.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it was very interesting. I had the pleasure of speaking to Adam Benedict from the Pine Barrens Institute, who's just written a book called Monsters in Print, which is covering historical stories of weird and wonderful monsters from the 19th and 20th century. And you allude to this in one of your chapters in regards to some of these older stories of wild men, as they were known. And I was talking to Adam about this, that all the experiences and stories that he seemed to have uncovered, I'd say 90% of them would tend to be talking about what we would now call Bigfoot.
Yes, absolutely. And that's kind of been a forgotten thread of evidence on the whole Bigfoot saga, is that, you know, as I mentioned, the name Bigfoot didn't become well known until 1958. Sasquatch, that name, which was actually an anglicized version of a very difficult to pronounce native name, Chehalis name, became prevalent in the 1920s. But prior to that, there were accounts of what were referred to typically as wild men. And as you suggest, they were often described as being, you know, looking very similar to a Bigfoot, very large, brutish, man-like creatures covered in hair. So wild man was a common name for these, or description for these creatures when they were encountered. Oftentimes they were also called big hairy apes or gorillas, or related to, you know, even though they certainly didn't look like gorillas because they were walking around on their hind legs like men. But yeah, there are many, many accounts that appeared in newspapers throughout the 19th century, primarily here in North America, but I imagine on other continents where they have Bigfoot type creatures as well, Yetis and so forth. Mm. And in fact, just recently, a colleague of mine named Chad Arment has come out with a really monumental book called Historical Bigfoot. And it's like 1,000 pages long, and it's just chocked full of these sort of dusty newspaper archives that refer to these Bigfoot type creatures encountered in past decades and centuries. So if anyone's really interested in the historical aspect, that is an excellent book to check out as well.
Absolutely. I think for me, it's interesting that there are several authors and researchers now who seem to be taking a historical slant to basically fleshing out the Bigfoot mythos, Ken, because I think it's one of those misconceptions that in certain aspects of the media, for them, Bigfoot didn't exist till 1958, and then we had all the tracks, and that's when it happened. But I know you allude to it quite a couple of times in the book. We've got hundreds of years of Native American and First Nations people stories from all across the continent who talk about these creatures that just seems to have been put to one side as irrelevant, which I think does them a complete disservice.
Yeah, you know, it's always been my view that it's exceptionally disrespectful to any culture to disregard their quote unquote legends, folklore, stories. I mean, out of every legend, there, you know, typically stems from some grain of truth. I mean, I fully believe that. And I've been very fortunate to travel around the world and experience different cultures in the, you know, the Amazon jungle and the Aboriginal people of Australia and so on and so forth. And many times the animals that have been quote unquote discovered over the past century or two by Western scientists were well known to the local people and were an integral part of their traditions and their stories and folklore and so forth. So Bigfoot fits perfectly into that paradigm as well. You know, I view it as an undiscovered, albeit remarkable, animal. And, you know, the native peoples have lived alongside of them for centuries. So to disregard that, I think, is very sad and very tragic. And as you said, that's a line of evidence that people have always kind of had in the back of their mind. Not as many people are familiar with the wealth of wild man stories and newspaper articles that we just referenced. Mm. And in addition to those two lines of evidence, I always like to point to the fact that we have in our fossil history many examples of hominins and hominids that looked very much like Bigfoot. So there's actual physical evidence that something like Bigfoot actually did exist, you know, millions of years ago, or maybe perhaps up until 100 or 50,000 years ago. So when you put all that together, I think it's a very compelling case that these things do exist.
Yeah. And I think obviously the advances that we've had in discovering new forms of human evolution over the last 20 years, which, yeah, you know, by the mid 90s, it was Homo sapiens and Neanderthals. And we now know we've got at least another six that have sprung up over the years. Obviously, you know, especially the Denisovans are one that seems incredibly perplexing, and the discovery of some relics of them in Nepal earlier this year, which is groundbreaking, really.
Yes, yeah, that's true. There have been a lot of amazing discoveries in the field of paleoanthropology in recent years. As you mentioned, the Denisovans, also Homo floresiensis, the Hobbit, as it's called, Homo luzonensis was a recent one. So yeah, you know, we now, the timeline has now shifted to where we know definitively that there were as many as six and perhaps more different hominin species inhabiting our planet. And 50,000 years ago is really just a blink of an eye in terms of, you know, the natural world. So, you know, there's another dynamic too, which is that the timeline for bipedalism, upright walking on two legs in hominids, has been pushed back, you know, at least 6 or 7 million years, and, you know, perhaps even earlier, and that timeline keeps getting pushed back. So again, things that look like Bigfoot, you know, if you want to refer to them as ape men, I guess that's an oversimplification, but big, hairy, brutish, you know, subhuman species that walked along, you know, walked our planet for millions of years, and up until very recently, walked alongside Homo sapiens.
Yeah, it's a fascinating period, I think, because when you look at what's going on in paleoanthropology and also in regards to the expanse of cryptozoology, I think we're very fortunate at the moment, Ken, to be in the middle, probably a golden age that we haven't seen since the early days of Ivan Sanderson and Tom Slick, where I think there's a real appetite out there now for people to, you know, get out there and boots on the ground to finally try and put this mystery to bed.
Well, that's true. I think there was a genuine period probably just after the Patterson-Gimlin film was shot, from the late 60s into the early 1970s, when I think many investigators were firmly convinced that we were literally on the verge of finding Bigfoot and of finding definitive physical evidence, a body or proof. And that, you know, kind of wavered a little bit. And you had another resurgence. These things are always cyclical. In the early 1980s, with the forming of the International Society of Cryptozoology, which, you know, incorporated, you know, many leading scientists in the field, from, as you said, the founders, Bernard Heuvelmans and Ivan Sanderson. You had guys like Roy Mackel and other dedicated investigators, many internationals around the world. And so then you had it sort of an organized scientific effort or pursuit. And then sadly, a lot of those pioneers began to fade, and then the interest now in Bigfoot is at an all-time high, I think, because of the proliferation of social media and YouTube channels and so on and so forth, a lot of popular television shows. So Bigfoot is always very, very much in sort of the public eye in terms of being an iconic legend, as most people view it as not being a real creature. I think the advantage we have these days is, of course, the technology in terms of DNA and eDNA technology advancing, things like drones and thermal imaging. And so we've got all these great gadgets now to penetrate the forest deep at night. It is frustrating, though, for those of us, you know, I work closely with many of the leading Bigfoot investigators, and at times we do feel as though we're kind of going in circles, because we really haven't been able to advance the evidence really much at all in the past decades. But you know, I think we're all sort of eternal optimists, and we think we're still perhaps on the cusp of finding that definitive proof.
Yeah, I think the one stick that we'll all get beaten with, Ken, those of us that are believers, and I consider myself to be all in on this, is the body never turning up or anything. But there's a nice section in your book where you reference a friend of yours called Lee Hales, I believe, who works at Yosemite.
Yes.
And I've often found this kind of argument a bit of a dead end, because, as you refer to, most people don't find wolves or bear carcasses in the wild. They just don't turn up unless one's been, you know, shot or trapped.
Yes, this is true. Any wildlife biologist who's worked in the field, and thank you for mentioning my good friend Lee Hales, who's worked for many years as a zoologist and naturalist. And he's, you know, he kind of keeps me grounded because he's a little more skeptical than I am and a little more objective, but he's still open-minded. But yeah, he worked with bears. There's a group that works at Yosemite that's specifically charged with monitoring the bear populations. And, he mentioned that to me, that they never, in all the years that he worked there, they never found any of the workers, any remains of a bear. They, in fact, bears that had tracking devices affixed to them would also disappear, and they would never even find the bear or the tracking device. So bears, wolves, mountain lions, these are the apex predators here in North America. They're obviously very crafting, cunning animals, and typically they don't die by accident much. They're not hit by cars that often. They're not hunted. Bears a bit, but, you know, not typically. So therefore, these animals, when they do die, they tend to obscure their remains as they're dying or before they die, perhaps with the belief that they're just simply ill and they're going to recover, or perhaps there are other reasons. But these animals are good at obscuring their remains by crawling into low brush or, you know, impenetrable areas, and thus the remains are rarely found. Despite the fact that we know that there are some 400,000 bears in North America, and in the book, of course, we speculate about potential Bigfoot populations. The best guess at this point is probably somewhere around 4,000. So you consider there's probably 1,000 bears to every Bigfoot. So you're talking about an incredibly rare animal, and it is an apex predator. I think we could all agree on that. And it seems to be very cunning and crafty. So why would it not hide its remains or hide its body if it felt like it were going to die and pass away? And so, therefore you have a lot of obstacles to overcome in terms of finding a body or finding that physical evidence.
Yeah, and plus, of course, you've also got other predators out there. I know there was some famous footage that came to light a couple of years ago about a dead cow that was essentially buried within a few days by a badger. And that often gets overlooked as well, that if something passes away in deep wood or scrubland, it's essentially a buffet for everything else that lives there.
Yeah, that's a great word. It is a buffet, and you're right. Nothing is wasted in nature, and even when a very large animal dies, I mean, yeah, that's impressive regarding a cow or perhaps an elk. Peter Byrne, who wrote the foreword to my book, I think I once heard him mention that an African elephant that dies on the savanna, that its remains can be gone within a week. You know, you have not just the little things, the bacteria and the flies and the beetles and things, but you also have a horde of different types of animals that scavenge on a carcass, vultures and coyotes and badgers, as you mentioned, and even, you know, herbivores like mice and deer and antelope will actually pick up bones and chew on them because they crave certain minerals and calcium that they can get out of the bones. So the remains are scattered and they decompose very quickly. And there's another thing that I don't know if I mentioned this in the book. I kind of thought about this after the fact or was brought to my attention, that because most people aren't very experienced at identifying animal bones, it's very likely that someone in the past stepped right over a Bigfoot bone, perhaps a femur or other large bone in the woods, and just simply looked down at it and thought, wow, that's a big bone. I guess that belongs to a moose or a cow or what have you. But, you know, the first thing that wouldn't cross your mind is that might be a Bigfoot bone. I better collect that and scoop it up, you know, for later studies. So, that may be a case where Bigfoot bodies or remains have been literally stepped over in the wilderness.
Yeah, and you know, we're talking about, especially in the northwest of the United States and Canada, you know, you're talking about extremely densely forested areas with very few people living in and around there. It's not like the old days where perhaps a lot of people, there'd be like logging camps and things set up there. There just doesn't seem to be that kind of urbanization of these areas, purely because some of these areas are so remote, Ken.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, although there are and have been Bigfoot accounts virtually all over the continental United States, and perhaps even down into Mexico and Central America, you know, you have, as you mentioned, these vast wilderness areas. And that's, you know, seemed to be where we get most of the accounts and sightings of Bigfoot are, of course, on the Pacific coastal ranges of California, Washington, Oregon, British Columbia, the sort of the Cascade ranges have traditionally produced the vast number of sightings. And other sightings around the U.S., the majority of sightings tend to be in wilderness areas or near wilderness areas. So again, that makes a lot of sense in terms of building a case for a real animal, a biological animal, that would most certainly choose to live in those wilderness areas where it has better resources and a heavy brush that it can hide in, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, very intriguing.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there are some wonderful stories that you touch on in the book. There's one that's always been one of my favourite alleged Bigfoot stories. Primarily, and not because I've got some kind of bloodthirsty appetite for such stories, Ken, but the famous trapper story was a gentleman called Bauman.
Yes.
Now, that's quite unique as well, because we don't tend to have a fatal encounter in the vast majority of Bigfoot Sasquatch experiences. There tends to be a lack of want for the creature to actually interact. It tries to get away as often as it can, whether it disappears into the brush or it runs off or it shrieks or screams and does whatever it needs to do. But the Bauman case is quite unique in the fact that we end up with an alleged murder.
Yeah, it's a well-known story because it has kind of that murderous aspect to it. And I think it is important, Paul, that we try to filter out as much of the monster from Bigfoot as we can. You know, as much as we love to portray Bigfoot as a monster, and you know, based on its physical description, it most certainly fits all of the qualifications in terms of being just big and huge and hairy and sometimes smelly. But there are very, very few accounts of Bigfoot or Sasquatches physically attacking people, you know, or harming people. There are some old native legends, and a few stories here and there. But I think a lot of people like to sort of embrace or focus on the scarier aspects of Bigfoot, the physical appearance, and the Bauman affair is an old story, but it was chronicled by none other than President Theodore Roosevelt, who many historians will acknowledge was a great naturalist, colorful character, and just kind of an all-out outdoorsman. But he, according to Teddy, had met this old mountain man named Bauman, who had recounted this story to him, and it supposedly occurred in Idaho in a place called the Wise River during the mid-1800s. And Bauman and his partner were out there trapping beavers in this kind of pristine wilderness area. They had heard a story that the remains of another trapper had turned up mutilated in prior years. And so they were a little hesitant to go into this area, but they knew there might be a bounty of beaver pelts they could collect. And almost immediately they began to, when they were returning to their camp from setting traps, they were finding these, their camp had been disrupted, something had been rummaging through their belongings and leaving behind huge footprints. And Bauman and his partner were both experienced outdoorsmen, and they immediately recognized that these were not bear tracks, and moreover, that these footprints seemed to indicate that whatever was leaving them was walking on its hind legs, which was very unnerving to them. And then one evening, as they were kind of sleeping in their lean-to, Bauman sensed the presence of this big, hairy animal looming in the opening of their lean-to, and he took a shot at it with his rifle, and whatever it was crashed away into the brush. Well, that was kind of the final straw for Bauman and his partner, so they decided they were going to break camp and get out of there the following day. And Bauman volunteered to go out and collect all of the remaining beaver traps while his partner packed up their belongings. And when Bauman returned to camp a little bit late at the end of the day, He at first didn't see the body of his partner, but as he got closer, saw sort of the slumped body of his partner on the ground. And it, according to the story, the body had two puncture wounds in the neck, and the neck was broken. And it was almost as if in Bauman's mind that whatever had killed his partner had sort of flipped the body around and played with it, which is kind of a diabolical way to think about things. But
yes.
So anyways, Bauman got out of there as quickly as possible. And of course, he ended up telling the story to Teddy Roosevelt. So here you have a very old story of Bigfoot, alleged Bigfoot aggression. That's very unnerving.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. I think it's one of those things that a lot of people are becoming more aware of in recent years, kind of in regards to Teddy Roosevelt, because he was a very forward thing. Essentially, you could call him an early cryptozoologist, because he was very interested in very strange creatures. He seemed to have a real thirst for knowledge.
Yeah, he was an adventurer. I'm admittedly not a Teddy Roosevelt historian, but I've heard many stories about his and I think he should be recognized for founding some of the first national parks, very large national parks here in the United States, which was, you know, I think important and is still important today to conserve a lot of that habitat. But you're right, he did seem to be kind of like a very colorful guy and kind of one of the earliest cryptozoologists for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's one of the great chapters in the book is a kind of breakdown of everyone who you really need to know about, I think, in regards to the history of Bigfoot research. When you do a chapter like that, Ken, is it difficult not to spend too much time on specific individuals? And the one good thing that you refer to in the book is that you don't really want to promote very well-known people with some dubious evidence, shall we say.
Yes.
But there is one particular person that perhaps is a very decisive character in the history of Bigfoot, which is Paul Freeman.
Mm.
Which, to my shame, I wasn't really aware of Paul Freeman until about 3 or 4 years ago. I'd never really come across his work or the scandal around him. So when you had that kind of chapter and you were setting down who were you going to cover, was that quite difficult to sort of filter them out?
Absolutely, and I appreciate you bringing that up, because, you know, first of all, I think it's important that the new generation of Bigfoot researchers, and there'll always be a newer generation until we find the proof, mm-hmm. Recognize and acknowledge that there were pioneers in this field that dedicated decades and in some cases lifetimes to searching for the evidence, and sadly were never able to fulfill that quest. Mm-hmm. So you could literally write, I think, a really excellent book on just the investigators in the field through the years, many of them very colorful characters that Teddy Roosevelt would probably get along with swimmingly. But yeah, Paul Freeman is a name that I think has been forgotten in recent years. He was very prevalent or well-known in Bigfoot circles in the 1980s and 90s based on a lot of evidence that he was bringing out of a place called Mill Creek Watershed in the Umatilla National Forest, which is sort of in the southeastern region of Washington State and kind of also part of Oregon as well. Freeman was a forestry worker who was in charge of sort of monitoring elk populations and things like that in this particular watershed area. And in the early 1980s, I think it was 1982, he had an encounter, according to him, with a Bigfoot, just stepped right out of he was walking down a logging road, and this thing just stepped out of the brush right in front of him. And of course it changed his world. He had never considered, he had been a lifelong hunter outdoorsman and never thought that Bigfoot could exist. And according to Freeman, this was, you know, a pretty life shattering situation. And he did manage to get some footprints. Some of the footprints that he found in short order were looked at by some of his colleagues at the forestry department and declared to be fakes and hoaxed and so forth. But Freeman left his job shortly thereafter due to the scandal. But he also made contact with a physical anthropologist named Dr. Grover Krantz at Washington State University. And Grover is recognized as the first scientist, the first true academic since perhaps Bernard Hulmans and Ivan Sanderson, to become really involved in Bigfoot research. And, of course, he had impressive credentials as a physical anthropologist, was well respected in his field for some of his other work. And Grover had been involved in the Bigfoot investigation since the late 1960s or 70s. Or early 1970s, but Freeman was able to make contact with him and bring some of his evidence, which included casts of footprints, casts of handprints, alleged hair samples, some weird tree twists and branches that he had cut off in the woods. And Krantz was very impressed with the some of his evidence. He felt that he saw some dermal skin ridges or dermatoglyphics in some of the foot and hand casts, which was very convincing to Grover. He thought that the morphology of the footprints seemed very dynamic and natural, not faked at all. So Grantz was kind of a huge advocate of Freeman's evidence. And in 1996, a Bigfoot investigator who's probably well known these days, Dr. Jeff Meldrum, who appears on a lot of television shows, another physical anthropologist and kind of Grover Krantz's protege, traveled out on a surprise visit to meet up with Paul Freeman at his home in Washington, and Freeman took him immediately to a fresh trackway that Jeff was just – his mind was blown, because, again, he was kind of on the fence as far as whether Bigfoot could actually exist or not. And he was convinced when he saw this trackway, and he made a number of casts of those as well. So Freeman, through the years, was really able to get, you know, two pretty impressive academics, physical anthropologists, on his side. And some of his to this day, some Freeman sadly passed away several years ago due to health issues, but, you know, to this day, much of his evidence is viewed by some of the academics in the field as still being very compelling. But the fact that he did it at one point at least admit that he had faked some footprints, you know, that obviously cast aspersions on all of his other findings as well. And he also produced a video film in the early 1990s of two alleged Bigfoots that's very controversial. So I think the fact that Freeman was able to produce so much alleged evidence, I think, created a lot of people to be very skeptical of him, including some of the old school researchers like Rene de Hinden and Bob Titmus thought that he was just basically tricking Grover and Meldrum into believing that this evidence was true. So, like many things in the Bigfoot field, this whole line of evidence is highly controversial. You know, although on the one hand, a lot of it looks very good and very realistic, the fact that Freeman was, you know, had admitted to hoaxing footprints at one point, and also seemed to produce quite a substantial amount of evidence, which is, you know, a lot of investigators are not able to do despite spending a lot of time in the field. So
yeah, sometimes I think it's too much of a good thing, I think, is probably the issue a lot of people have with Paul Freeman's work, Ken.
That's it. There seems to be so much of it. You know, and that is problematic. You know, similarly, Paul, I mean, I've been investigating Bigfoot for many decades. I've been in the field actively for about 20 years, the past 20 years, and other researchers like Rene de Hinden and John Green spent decades out in the field looking. But I occasionally run across Bigfoot researchers, including some of my colleagues, that claim that they've had multiple sightings, 5 sightings, 6 sightings, 4 sightings, whatever. And, you know, not to discount their claims, because I'm not in the nature of attacking people's integrity or questioning them, but it, you know, that is a problematic scenario. You know, why is it that some people are able to have multiple sightings to find abundant evidence, while other people who are seemingly just as intelligent and dedicated and in the same areas don't? So yes. I mean, that's a conundrum I deal with on a daily basis.
Yeah. With the greatest respect, I don't think some people are that lucky.
Well, you know, that's one way of looking at it, for sure.
But I mean, it is really good, and I like that these kind of like mini biographies that you've got in there, Ken, because for someone like me who's read the stories of the infamous Four Horsemen, as they were known, I've grown up just having such admiration for Peter Byrne. Peter's always been one of my. I could listen to Peter talk. You could read a phone book out. I could listen to Peter talk about anything, to be fair. I think it's a real aspect of the Bigfoot history that, like you've referred to there, I really do think that we're probably overdue a really good in-depth look at that particular period of the late 50s and early 60s when these guys were, you know, on the ground in the Pacific Northwest, really trying to push the boundaries of what was science at the time.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, the Four Horsemen, as you mentioned, I think I've probably mentioned all of their names here already. But there's a fifth horseman who's Bob Titmuss.
Yep.
And, you know, again, one of the impetus to write this book was that last year I was speaking at a Bigfoot conference, fairly well-attended Bigfoot conference, and I asked the audience for a show of hands if anyone knew who Bob Titmuss was. And I was shocked that out of almost 200 people, not a single person raised their hand.
Wow.
Bob Titmuss was not as well known as the other horsemen because he never published any books. Mm. He didn't really appear on television much. He would typically take he shared his findings with his good friends John Green and Grover Krantz on a regular basis. And I guess he worked with DeHinnan sometimes as well, and perhaps Peter. Not so much Peter. I think they had a bit of a tiff. But but Titmuss was, you know, he should be recognized for a few reasons. One is that in 1958, when big footprints began showing up on this logging road in Northern California, he was the one that suggested that his friend Jerry Crew take some plaster of Paris out there and make a cast of one of these footprints so that he could bring it back to town and people could study it. And so that was very clever. So that's where we actually owe Bob Titmuss a huge debt, because that particular print that was cast by his friend ended up in the newspapers and the name Bigfoot was born. Also, Titmuss was part of the original Pacific Northwest expedition, which involved – he was the leader – the initial leader of an expedition that included John Green, Rene DeHinnan, Jerry Crew, and Ivan Marks and others. And but later on, he kind of became disenfranchised with that expedition. He moved up to British Columbia to be closer to his friend John Green. And he spent years and years out in the field. He found a number of footprints through the years. He had a boat. He would go up and down the British Columbia coast and stop on different isles looking for evidence. And produced a lot of impressive evidence through the years, but a lot of it and his name have been long forgotten because he didn't publish or appear on television much. But we owe Bob Titmuss a huge debt of gratitude for his many years of research in the field.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair comment to be fair, Ken. And I think the reasons you put forward for him not being, I mean, I am very surprised that no one had heard of him because, you know, here I am in Sheffield, and I've heard of Bob Titmuss, and I've been aware of him for quite a number of years. Obviously, since I first started reading about Bigfoot and Ivan Sanderson's work, and seeing some of the old documentaries that came out in the 70s and the episodes of In Search of, so that's really surprising that, as you say, probably one of the most important people in the whole history of this great search. Seems to have been so forgotten.
Yes, yeah, it's very sad, but you know there are other probably dozens, if not hundreds, of other investigators that have spent years in the field. Perhaps didn't find as much as Bob Titmuss and the others, but sadly those names have been forgotten too. And there's, you know, I know a few of them off the top of my head. I mentioned Sheriff Joe Dunn earlier from 1941. There was a guy named Al Hodgson down in Bluff Creek, California, that was kind of a lightning rod, the epicenter of a lot of research that was coming through the area. He was the one that tipped off Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin to go to the Bluff Creek in 1967, and subsequently they got the film. Mm-hmm. There was a guy in Michigan named Art Capa that spent years and years, you know, and just so many of those types of investigators through the years that were Al Olson is a guy that built a giant cage out in the wilderness, and he was going to try to trap a Bigfoot. He had this giant steel cage that he'd put out there, and you know, so a lot of forgotten names, sadly, of people, pioneers, real pioneers in the spirit of Teddy Roosevelt, guys that went out in the wilderness and searched for evidence, and sadly their names have been forgotten, but they have all played an important role in contributing, you know, research and in some cases evidence to the Bigfoot pursuit.
Yeah. Yes, I think it's a really good aspect of that, and I think it's probably something that really needs a real light shining on it, and we can look back on those halcyon days. I mean, because it must have been so exciting, because obviously we'd got the big explosion really sort of came from the Himalayas with the Shipton photo. Regardless of what people think about that, that just set everything in motion on both sides, because I'm trying to think who I spoke to, and somebody was on about, they were talking about the Yeti, and somebody said, oh, well, why go to the Himalayas when we've got them here in British Columbia?
Yeah, that was kind of Peter Byrne, you know, of course, spent years searching for the Yeti in the Himalaya, beginning in the 1940s, and he of course ran Tom Slick's first two Yeti expeditions in 1957-58. But in 1959, when Tom Slick convinced him to come over to the U.S. to California and take over leadership of the Pacific Northwest expedition, Byrne, of course, like most people, was pretty skeptical at first, thinking, "Oh, really? There can't be something like the Yeti that lives in California? I mean, that just sounds absurd." But when he got over to California and realized how much habitat there was in Northern California in those pretty remote areas, there was certainly the potential was there for something like Bigfoot to exist. And moreover, as Byrne once stated, there were a lot of advantages in shifting from the Himalaya to California. He suddenly had better communications. There were more roadways that he could get better access to certain areas, better, you know, just better resources. Whereas in the Himalaya, my understanding is that Peter and his brother Brian, you know, spent, you know, a lot of time living miserably in caves, sleeping in caves, and relying heavily on the local Sherpa people to help them and guide them and carry their stuff around. And it was probably very frustrating and slow going. But the Yeti, you know, it's got this romantic, something about the Yeti, of course, has this, you know, and it probably is symbolic of the Himalayas themselves and, you know, the allure of Everest in that region. But you know, the notion that there could be this great man-ape living up in the greatest mountain range on the planet is a very romantic notion. And, I'm quite jealous of all of my colleagues that have had an opportunity to go over there and do research. I've never been over there yet, but, I certainly think logistically it is going to be much harder to find conclusive proof. And there's certainly an abundance of proof or anecdotal proof that these things exist over here in the Americas.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that is one of the tantalizing things about some of the other alleged large hominids from around the world, Ken, that there seems to be a certain aspect to especially the ones on this side of the Atlantic. Obviously, the Yeti is the most famous, but I think that two of the most intriguing that I've come across are obviously the Almasti and the Yeren, because there seems to be a real more of a scientific acceptance in regards to the possibility that these relic species have somehow survived.
Yeah, well, that's true. And I think a lot of as you mentioned, the floodgates kind of opened in 1951 when the Shipton photographs were published. And at that time, the Soviet Union, I think, wanted to be much like we had a race to get to the moon. There was probably a race to find the Yeti or something like the Yeti. Mm. And there was also, of course, an excellent anthropologist in Russia named Boris Porchev. And he was kind of the pioneer of what's referred to over there as hominology and the study of archaic or relic hominids. And then you also had a researcher named Jean Marie Kaufman, who was born in France, moved to Russia. She was a mountain climber and a surgeon and kind of a colorful character. But she spent many years on a commissioned investigation of the Caucasus Mountains and turned up literally hundreds of eyewitness accounts of a local relict hominid that was referred to as generally as the Almasti. I guess the name Almasti extends from Russia through Mongolia and into some of those other Asian mountain ranges. The descriptions are notably different than the traditional Bigfoot in terms of people describe the Almasti as being a little, perhaps a bit more human-like in terms of having more of a human-like appearance, still hairy and hair-covered and still very ugly and swarthy, but oftentimes the Almastis will come near much closer to human habitation, sit around or scavenge from food sheds and storage areas and even at times crawl into tents and things with people. So very similar to the Chinese Yeren as well. Yeah, it's kind of weird. One of my favorite Yeren stories, Paul, is and I don't remember the exact year or incidents, but there's an account of some Chinese workers sitting around a fire at night after a long, hard day at work. They had built up this bonfire and they were sitting around, and a Yeren came up and sits down amongst them. And just kind of crosses its legs and sits down between them to warm up by the fire. And all the Chinese workers are kind of looking at each other and poking each other. What do we do now? You know, this thing is sitting next to us and they all just kind of – yeah, it's kind of a funny account. I forget where I read that, but it's one of the better ones. But, and the Chinese government in 1976, there was a famous account of a Yeren sighting that involved several Chinese – Communist Party officials in an area, Shenzhou Reserve, where there have been a lot of Yeren sightings. And then that sort of was the impetus for a Chinese expedition to search for evidence of the Yeren in that region and involved a number of official personnel, soldiers, and so forth. So there have been in Asia, it seems, some concerted and sort of government-sponsored or endorsed expeditions to search for evidence of the Yeti, Almasti, and Yeren, whereas, of course, here in the Americas, we don't have anything approaching that. The the scientific foundations, establishments, the government, all of those official bodies have been very reluctant to give Bigfoot any credibility whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, it is an often, for me, it's a real source of frustration, I think, because my stepfather was a doctor of chemistry, so I've always been brought up on the belief that science is there to push the boundaries of knowledge, Ken. And regardless of what you think of such creatures, I mean, currently there is a fantastic show on the Nat Geo channel, which is called Extinct and Alive.
Featuring great show.
Forrest Gallant, who is a remarkably adventurous man. And I mean, he's, as far as I'm aware, all the episodes I've seen, he's found three species that were, by all intents and purposes, written off as extinct by science. And he's done this show for, 3 years, and he's found at least three species.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable what he's done. And it's, as you state, I mean, what is the vehicle that was used there was a television show. It wasn't a scientific foundation. It wasn't National Geographic. It was, it was basically someone that had the funding to get him to these locations. And that was a television production company or network, which is fine because the result has been staggering. So, but sadly, there's just not a lot of interest from the scientific. Yeah, I think that's changing a little bit. Mm. I mean, you've heard people like Jane Goodall come forward and say that Bigfoot might exist. George Schaller, the world-famous zoologist who's worked with gorillas and snow leopards, he's come out and stated that we should be open-minded to the possibility that these things exist. So I think that the tide is slowly turning, Paul, but sadly not quite fast enough.
Absolutely. Well, there's a couple of other stories that you touch on. One for me is something that I remember the first time I saw a picture of this as a child. I was about 9, and it's Dolores's ape. from the yes. from South America, and that picture at the time scared me half to death, as it would do if as a 9-year old and you're being told that yes, there's giant creatures running about South America. Would you say that's probably one of the most controversial cases in the history of cryptozoology?
Yes, I think so. And just to give it a little bit more backstory, as you suggested, in 1920, there was an expedition that was going on in Colombia, Venezuela. And there was a geologist named Francois Deloise, and the expedition was failing terribly. Due to a disease and attacks by natives and so on and so forth. So, but according to Deloise, where they were camped along Venezuela's Rio Tara River, these two Bigfoot-like creatures came out of the brush, approached him and his party in a aggressive manner, and subsequently they shot one of the creatures. The other one went off into the bush, and they took a picture of this dead primate kind of propped up on a wooden oil crate with a stick under its chin to keep it upright. And when the picture surfaced a few years later, it created a huge controversy in the field of anthropology, because noted French anthropologist George Montandon declared that it was a representative of a new species of apes, of South American ape. Now, of course, we don't have any apes in South America that we know of, only some monkeys and large monkeys. So that was controversial. And of course, Montandon was immediately questioned by some of his colleagues in the field of anthropology that said, no, it's just a spider monkey. It's not an ape. Well, I think the reason that it's become so controversial in the field of cryptozoology is because the photo was, of course, endorsed by Bernard Heuvelmans, the father of cryptozoology, who published it in his classic work On the Track of Unknown Animals, and endorsed it as being an actual real photograph, genuine photograph of an unknown creature. So that was, and that particular image has been reproduced in various Bigfoot books and cryptozoology books through the years. But as often happens through the years, the true story has come out, and essentially most now recognize that in fact the subject in the photo is merely a large, outsized and bloated dead spider monkey with its tail hidden. So the question then becomes, why did Montandon potentially proliferate this particular hoax, particularly in light of the fact that, you know, he and his crew were essentially dying of starvation in the jungle at the time and really, really just clinging on to life. So it just seems like an odd thing for somebody to sort of fake a photograph like that. But anyways, I think that's one of the hoaxes that needs to be dispelled, and you know, we need to sort of let go of some of those lingering hoaxes and things that have colored our perception of the Bigfoot mystery.
Yeah, very true. I mean, it is a perplexing photograph, and like you say, I think the footnote to that initially gave it the credence, as you referred to there, Ken, was the fact that this expedition was an absolute disaster, because they were dropping like flies. I think there was only three of them survived the trip, wasn't there?
Yeah, something like that. Out of a group of maybe a dozen or more. So, and you know, it is curious that the photo didn't surface right away. When Montandon was a friend of Deloise, and I guess came across the photograph at a later time, and so Deloise didn't immediately try to push it as this unknown ape that he had discovered or anything, which is kind of weird. Another weird aspect is cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman has pointed out that there appears to be some plants in the background, I think banana trees and things, that are not in fact endemic to that particular region of Venezuela. So that is just another weird twist to the story, is perhaps the photo wasn't even taken in Venezuela, but hoaxed at a later date or location or something.
Yeah. Well, stranger things have happened, Ken.
Yeah, always. and continue to happen.
So, in regards to your field research then, Ken, you have a chapter about your excursions out there into the field on there. What would you say so far has been your most compelling personal experience throughout your career so far?
Well, that's easy, and of course I read about it in the book, but I've never seen Bigfoot with my own eyes, but I'm convinced that I've been very close to these creatures at least on one or two or maybe three occasions, but the one that really stands out is on August 18, 2003, I was with some other researchers, three other researchers, and we were investigating a location called Cottonwood Lake in North Texas. And we had heard that some campers had been chased out of the woods by something resembling a Bigfoot. So it was kind of a dramatic account. Mm. When we went in there on that evening, we decided to take a hike around the lake starting when the sun went down. And we began to hear these grunting noises, very loud, very aggressive and powerful, emanating from some thick brush, probably about 40 yards away from us. And we immediately looked at each other, and we all acknowledged that these were ape-like sounds. They couldn't be related to any known animal in Texas or in the United States or North America for that matter. So it sounded like a powerful ape. I had a recorder going, so I was able to record the sounds. And we were not able to penetrate the brush. It was a little bit daunting, so we couldn't actually see this thing. We did go to a higher viewing point on a levee overlooking the lake and shined a spotlight down. And at that point, we saw two eyes shining at us from the location where we'd heard these noises. They appeared very high off the ground, though it was hard to tell. So we did see some eye shine of something. Hmm. And the following morning, we set camp in that area, and there were these moaning sounds throughout the night, these I call them sorrowful moaning sounds that were echoing across the lake, very eerie. And the next morning when we made our way through the brush in daylight, we found some deep, very, very deep footprints, man-shaped footprints in the sand on this little beach adjacent to the lake. And we also found several turtle shells that had been ripped in half from top to bottom. And there was no meat or any remains of there was no turtle flesh. It was just the shells that had been cleanly ripped and torn in half, which is quite remarkable if you've ever picked up a turtle shell and tried to imagine tearing it in half with your bare hands. Mm. So the culmination of all of that is kind of the most convincing thing that I've ever experienced, and that convinced me that these things must exist. Between the sounds, which were very primate-like, the footprints, the eye shine, and the mutilated animal carcasses, I mean, all of it to me it was quite a remarkable evening.
Yeah, fabulous. Well, I can't recommend the book highly enough, Ken. It's a phenomenally researched piece of work. It's well written. It's highly addictive, and I recommend it for anybody who's new to the subject or as well read as I like to think I am. I think it's a superb tome, and congratulations to you. You must be very satisfied with it, Ken.
Thank you, Paul. I'm humbled by your kind words, and I've gotten tremendous feedback from many of my colleagues who I greatly respect. Many of them contributed to the book as well. So as much as I like to take credit for things, there were a lot of brains that I picked, a lot of extensive interviews that I conducted with many of the leading investigators in the Bigfoot field in order to put it all together. So, but thank you so much for your kind words. I'm glad you enjoyed the book, and I encourage anyone that's interested in the subject to give it a look.
Absolutely. So, before I let you go, Ken, what does 2020 have on the horizon for you?
Well, I have a number of lectures. I'm always actively doing lectures across North America. Sadly, I haven't been able to make it across the pond yet, but I'll be making appearances at Bigfoot conferences from Tennessee to Texas to Michigan, Wisconsin, North Carolina, pretty much all over the place. So I'll be doing a lot of lectures. Excuse me. No television shows in the works as of yet. In addition to promoting the Bigfoot book, I have a number of other leads. Of course, I'm interested, Paul, in investigating other mysterious creatures, cryptids as well. So I have some interesting leads on some cases that involve sightings of thunderbirds and lake monsters and some other remarkable creatures. So I'm looking forward to delving into some of those other subjects as well.
Fabulous. So where can everybody keep up to date with your work, Ken, and purchase The Essential Guide to Bigfoot?
Well, thanks again for having me on, Paul. The Essential Guide to Bigfoot is available on Amazon, US, as well as UK and I believe Australia and some other places as well, so people can find it there. If they'd like a signed copy, they can reach out to me on social media. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I also have a website, which is kengerhard.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you once again for taking the time to speak to me today. It's been a pleasure as always. Thank you for coming back.
Always a pleasure, Paul. Yeah. Really enjoyed speaking with you today.
You're very welcome. Well, listen, you have a great Christmas and a happy new year. And I look forward to keeping up with your adventures next year. And I wish you all the very best, Ken. Thank you again.
Sounds good. You as well. We'll talk soon, Paul.
Take care.
Cheers.